I'm going to talk a little bit more, give some examples of what we really mean by the inner friend and what it means to have a relationship with different, really with the different ways that I treat myself internally. Because outer friend, when you're just friend, how do we treat, to be a friend to somebody, what does that mean in the world? It means lots of things, but one, I think, is that there's somebody who loves you and respects you and is happy to see you and, you know, cares about you and wants to help. And has that very kind of positive relationship with you, and you look forward to seeing each other, you know. And when you're with that person, you can just relax and be yourself, and you don't have to be on guard and am I going to say the right thing and all this kind of stuff, you know. So there's this freedom, you know, relaxation, because you're with your friend. You know, so internally we want to, our psyche and all the little ones inside, you know, and even the conscious mind that is in the ego, not in a negative way, but just the person who's engaged in the world and talking with people, meeting with people, doing this, doing that. Also, we want the way that we talk to that person on a conscious level, you know, should be that of a friend, so that there's a support system inside, not somebody who's tearing me down or always critical or I don't think you're going to be able to do that right, you always do things wrong, you always do things incorrectly, you know, and here you go again, I think you're going to blow it. You know, imagine trying to give a talk or something with that kind of voice going on, or you're going for a job interview, there's no way you can do this, you're going to be a nervous wreck and I know you can't really handle it. You shouldn't even go. So what a hard life when you have to have that internal voice talking at you in that way. So now, how to change that? When we say we bring in the inner friend, now where is the inner friend located, in a sense, in relationship to the critic or the one who is angry or whatever it is, you know, critical, angry, always putting you down. That inner friend is not going to be in front of the critic, so the critic becomes the observing ego. Oh, now you're trying to be an inner friend. And you're not doing a very good job. That's not going to work. So the inner friend has to be behind the one who's observing, you know, the all of it in turn, including that kind of the critical voice, and the one who's always putting you down. So there's a lot of in that inner friend has to kind of be able to kind of bring in some psychology. You know, it can say, no, it's okay. It's okay, no, don't worry. But it has to know and maybe have some inner dialogue with that critical voice, understanding that critical voice is something that you used when you were little, really as a defense. I was talking earlier today, it's like something to ward off that anticipatory anxiety because you're just expecting to be criticized. You're expecting to be put down by a family member or somebody who's close to you at a young age. And so you're waiting, you know, to be criticized or waiting to be told how stupid you are, incompetent you are. And so it's just a horrible feeling when you're trying to do something and you're just waiting, you know, to be criticized. So instead the defense system will just start criticizing you so that you don't have to wait anymore, because waiting is almost waiting for the criticism. Because of catastrophic thinking, which is a tendency in the mind, waiting for the criticism is almost worse than the criticism. Because at least when the criticism comes, it's over now, you know, and I've endured it. But waiting for it builds up a lot of tension. So the psyche will just do it for you so that you can get rid of the terrible anticipation of being embarrassed or shamed or, you know, hurt or put down. So it will just start preempting that in order to give you some freedom, then it'll be over, and then you can go on, you know. So you know that, and so you have that knowledge, and so you can talk to the defense system as it's really the defense system that protected you as a little girl or little boy, like when you're 2, 3, 4, 5. It all started. And that's why often you have no consciousness of it, because you're so used to it, you know. It's like the water's cold, but it's always cold, so I don't know it's cold, because it's never been any different. Mm-hmm. And so the psyche talks like this, is like this, creates this environment, because that's what the psyche does. I don't even know. One of my nieces told me that when she was a little girl, she always, after eating, she always had a stomach ache and felt sick after eating, you know? And she thought, all growing up, she thought, well, when you eat, you know, it makes you sick. Eating gives you a stomach ache. She just assumed that because she always had a stomach ache after she ate. Because how would she know differently unless she said something? And we'd say, no, you're not supposed to have a stomach ache like that. Let's go see a doctor or something. My brother was very nearsighted, and it wasn't until... My mother feels so ashamed about this, but anyway, it wasn't until he was 8 or 9 that for some reason they had his eyes tested. And he was very nearsighted, and so they got him some glasses, and when they took him home, he looked out the window, and he said, there's mountains. Oh my God, my mom never forgot that. But how would he know? How would he know? Because those are just his eyes, right? That's how we are. The things that are defense systems, the things that are set in place when you're little, you know, that's just how it is. And so you're barely even conscious of a lot of negative or painful self-talk. Often, or even if you're conscious of it, it's just that's the way the mind is. You know, when you make a mistake or you're worried about not doing something well, the mind will just, you know, talk about that and tell you, you know, that you're not going to do well and, you know, you're right, you're not very smart. whatever awful things it has to say. But these are actually all things that we've picked up along the way when we're too young to know the difference. So now we can know that, and in a simple way, when that negative self-talk comes, you can say, no, no, you don't. That's not true. You picked that up when you were little. You just talk, and you say the opposite. Something like, no, no, you're a wonderful little girl, talking to the little one. Oh, that's not true. You're beautiful. Definitely you can do this. So, but now how to know what to say to that critical voice. And so one way that I think is good is you do some inner child work with the critical voice, and you think, and the one who's being victimized by that critical voice, you know, and think of that critical voice as a parent figure or some, just remember the ways that what caused you to pick that up in the first place, you know? What type of talk was causing you to pick that up, that self-talk as a defense? And then you think this, how do I wish, how would have I liked to be talked to rather than the way I'm talking now as that critical voice? How would I like to have been talked to? And then you talk that way. You know, like say if you say, no, no, that's not how it is. You're really. And then say the things that in your mind you would have loved to hear, you know. And then that's kind of personalized to you, you know. Because you received these messages, but the messages that would have been what you would have wanted would have been this. And so you think about what would have that been. And as you say those things to yourself, you feel like a release and an opening up inside. And a kind of a, I don't know, like a pain letting go. You know? And then you know that's right. Those are the kinds of things I should say. And then you have to start listening to how you talk to yourself. And when these critical voices of one thing or another come in, then those are the things that you say. And recognizing that that critical voice, that's just a little three-year-old defense system that's trying to do a job to protect you. So you can say, you don't have to do that job anymore. You know, you when you're doing inner child work, you don't have to do that job anymore. You are doing that to try to help me, to protect me. You know, but actually, you know, you're a beautiful little girl. You've done this and you did this. You're very smart, you know. All the things that are true, you know, but we're not acknowledged. Little children are brilliant little beings. They're so creative. They have so much going on for them, you know. They're so cute, you know. So all of those things you say, you know, and you feel inside your heart opening, the heart of the little one opening that's constricted inside. So that's what you want to do in meditation. You want to give, you spend time on that type of stuff in order to neutralize and transform that little voice that it was trying to help you, you know. Defense system is trying to help you, to protect you. But then the thing is, we're stuck with it. It was helping like a three-year-old or a four-year-old, but now it's helping like a 40-year-old, right? And it's not helpful anymore. In fact, it's holding you back. But it doesn't know that until it's something transforms and actually is coming into relationship with that defense system to kind of give it permission to leave because you can handle the situation now. There's one story. So this is just another, it's kind of a another thing that kind of works. I'll just tell you a little personal story. When I was a little girl, I must have been about five, because my brother had just been born and he was a baby. My father was in the Navy at that time, and so I think he actually missed my brother's birth, you know, because he was overseas in Korea in the Navy. And so it was time for him to come home, and he was coming home, and I couldn't wait, I couldn't wait for him to get home, and I was so excited, and my mom dressed us all up, and we went down to the boat dock, waiting for this huge Navy ship to come in. And finally, we were waiting there and waiting there, and then finally now the ship comes in. It's huge, and you see all the sailors, you know, lined up looking for their family and everything, and we're looking for our father, and you know, my little brother's in my mom's arms. He's only probably three or four months. He's a baby. You know, maybe 5 or 6 months. He's not little tiny, but, you know, still a baby. Okay, so then they come, and we're looking and looking and looking. We think we see him way in the distance. We're all so excited. And then finally they come, all these sailors come down, and slowly, slowly, my mom's waving, you know, and my dad's looking. So he finally makes his way over, and I am so, so, so excited. And he walks toward us, right to my mom, and gives her a big hug and kiss. And the baby, Bill, my brother, is in her arms, you know. And he gives her a big hug and kiss and is so happy to see her. And then takes Bill, you know, and gives him a hug and says, the new baby, you know. And I'm just standing over there inside. And nobody's noticing me, you know. And I feel, and this, I'm talking like 5 years old, I feel mortified. That's the feeling. I'm absolutely mortified. I'm so ashamed. I'm so embarrassed because I was so excited. And I thought I was the center of his life. You know, he's my dad. I was the center, and I was the one that was going to be loved and picked up, and he couldn't wait to see me like I couldn't wait to see him. Nothing. And so what happened, and I still remember this so vividly, I was so embarrassed and so mortified. And to think a little child can be mortified, but it's the perfect word. I was absolutely mortified and embarrassed and just very embarrassed, very mortified. So anyway, what happened was everything in me shut down and I pretended like everything was fine. And I just walked along with them as they were also happy and walking along as though there was no problem. They still didn't even notice me in my memory, you know. And I was just walking along as a good little girl, you know, so everything was fine. But it was so traumatic, so awful that I have never forgotten the experience. That's how, you know, strong it was. Okay. So that experience was always in there, that kind of a, because you have some childhood experiences. I don't have many memories of childhood experiences, but the ones I do are like that, unfortunately. Okay, so then I came across, actually it was through a psychologist friend who was doing some particular type of work, and somehow, I don't know how we ended up talking about this, and she taught me this particular exercise to do that I tried, and it was really amazing. It's kind of a neuro-linguistic programming type of thing, but it's very pertinent for what we do. And what it is, so what she had me do was go through that whole memory, you know, as it was, the poet coming in, all of that, and him coming up. But instead of going to my mom and my little brother, he came to me and picked me up and held me and was so happy to see me. And I was so happy to be with him. So what happened as we relived this memory, the little traumatized girl, all of that just went away in this new visualization, you know, because it's exactly what I had, how I had imagined it would be, what I was expecting. And then I gave that to her. And she was ecstatic. I could feel the relief, you know, and the happiness. In fact, as I'm telling you the story, I kind of feel it inside, even now, because that was really a big deal, you know, for a child. But that's what we have to do. You give what you didn't get on an imaginal level. And Bhagawan has given us that safety valve, or that way of healing a trauma that actually happened, but we have ways of actually healing it and releasing it. But you have to reparent in a way and give what you didn't get, you know? Now they do things like this. So anyway, that's a very meaningful story for me. But even say they use these kind of techniques, and I use them in therapy when it's appropriate with my clients. Say, for instance, there's been instances that I've had to deal with clients where a child has, like, a brother, older brother, who has some friends, and they have been very abusive, sometimes sexually abusive, to their little sister, you know, or physically abusive. If they're two boys, it could even be the big brother, instead of being the protector, beats up on the little guy, you know, and he doesn't have anybody coming to his defense. And so what you can do is, when you have bully in your life, you have bullies or people who didn't, that you weren't protected, you can go internally, imaginally, and confront that brother or bully friend or whatever it is, bringing with you someone who can help you stand up to him or her and protect you and be on your side, you know. It's like the old stories where, so my sister was telling me once that her son was got kind of beaten up by some kids walking to school. So that's so moving for me. So what happened is that his dad started going down, you know, and walking him and looking for those kids. Straighten those kids out. And it, you know, protected him. You know, protected him. So to bring, you can imaginably bring in that protection. Like if a little kid is doing that, they might bring in, you know, Spider-Man or Superman, you know, or Supergirl or whatever, to come in as somebody who will stand with you and protect you. And with that support, then you can imaginably talk to your tormentors, you know, that type of thing. And so you can be creative to figure out by feeling. You feel like what is working, what that little girl or little boy needs. And then you bring that in. That's the amazing, beautiful thing about imagination. You can bring in what is needed to save the day. And then the little one, you know, gets saved and is relieved and so happy. And that releases a lot of trauma that's being held in your unconscious, held in your body, because you've had no way to transform it. See? So these are things, like I'm just showing you some examples and whatnot, but you can be creative and use these things. Imagination, you know, images, visualizations, are very connected with your emotions and the emotional system of the unconscious. They go together. And so you can actually find the, like if I think of that little girl in that situation, I see the image and the hurt are connected. And then if you bring in a situation where she is getting what she had imagined, then the image and the relief are connected. See what I mean? So you have to kind of love to be with your psyche and deal with it on an emotional level that has to that speaks in images. The psyche speaks much more in images and feelings, you know. So that's the type of work that we want to do in order to relieve ourselves of some of the traumas that we bring into adulthood that are just kind of abiding there, keeping our heart constricted. See what I mean? We can do it. It's a miracle. It's like Bhagavan gave us this incredible gift. So when you do the inner child work, you think, oh, this is so beautiful. Because things change. Right? You change inside. Because you're bringing in the type of love and support that your psyche needs, that all beings need. In some areas in life, you didn't get them, and so that's a crippling, little crippled part, you know, abiding there in the unconscious, because it needs that to be whole. It needs to be mirrored. In psychology, they, in the like 30s or 40s, it's totally illegal now, they used to do experiments with mirroring. You know what mirroring means? Like if I smile at you, you smile at me, you know, or if I'm concerned, you're concerned. If that mirroring isn't there, something is kind of jarring. It automatically takes place unless there's something really wrong. So they did an experiment where they put a little baby on the mother's lap. So the mother was actually sitting like this and the little baby was here. And then the little baby would be goo-gooing and try to get the mother's attention, but the mother was instructed that no matter what the baby does, don't show any expression. Honestly, this is absolutely illegal now because it was so traumatic for the child. So the baby would just start out, you know, trying to get the attention, not thinking anything, because you would always get it, right? You know, if you're looking at the mom or if you're smiling or doing something, mom will always, you know, mirror you and come back with that. the mother would not do anything at all. And so it would try harder, you know, start trying harder, and then try all different kinds of things, and it would start to whimper, you know, and get more and more upset because it was being totally unsuccessful, right? And within, you know, some short amount of time, it was almost having a psychotic break. It was totally beside itself. So they banned the experiment. And I hope they were able to save the little children, you know. You probably had no idea how devastating that is. There's a psychologist named Heinz Kohut. He's very, very well known in the psychological world. He passed away some time ago, but he's not that ancient. He's relatively new. Who said that mirroring is the oxygen of the soul. That's how important it is. Even for adults. It's very disconcerting to be with somebody and they don't mirror you back. Because you're excited and you're talking about something and they're just deadpan. You know? Or you're concerned about something and they're just deadpan. Or not giving, not their whatever their expression is, it's not at all mirroring you. And so it's very disconcerting. I think what is spontaneous and natural, if there's no type of anger or block or something there, is that there's a dance that's going on. You know, it's a beautiful dance that's going on between two people that's, you're not even aware of it, actually. It's just so natural. But when that dance is interrupted, it becomes, you know, very difficult. You know what I mean? So knowing these things, even in the inner child work, we, as we go in, the adult buddhi is going in, that child needs to be mirrored, needs to be understood, you know? You need to be with it, you need to be with its joy, with its happiness, and with its sadness, and with its fear, and, you know, you just have to be there in a real way. One of the things that Jung taught us, you know, is that to take the psyche and the experiences of the psyche and the little ones in the psyche is real. It's not just this reality. This is not the only reality. There's an internal reality, there's a subtle reality, there's a psychic reality that needs also, you know, to be respected and taken to be real. Just because if it's another dimension or it's a more subtle level than this physical level doesn't mean that it's any less real. May have different rules and all of that, but nevertheless, it's as real as this. You know, and so that type of care and respect really gives me just from this level of the psyche, a lot of room, a lot of space, a lot of comfort, a lot of depth, because it's acknowledged. You're not just one-dimensional. Because to the degree you're traumatized, the defense system so traumatized, it's doing such a job, it won't even let you in. You have to knock on the door and say, can I come in? You know, I love you, I want to come, I'm here. You know, to let you come in and have those dialogues. Okay, so, Om Tetsa.